When the church realized the nature of the forces that were invading Lamorkin, they summoned the church knights back from Rendor. They reinforced the ranks of the four orders with other knights and with common soldiers until the forces of the West were nearly as numerous as those of the Zemach horde of Otha.
Was there a battle then? Talon asked eagerly.
The greatest battle in the history of mankind, Barrett replied. The two armies met on the plains of Lamorkin near Lake Rendera. The physical battle was gigantic, but the supernatural battle on that plain was even more stupendous. Waves of darkness and sheets of flame swept the field. Fire and lightning rained from the sky. Whole battalions were swallowed up by the earth or burned to ashes in sudden flame. The crash of thunder rolled perpetually from horizon to horizon, and the ground itself was torn by earthquakes and the eruption of searing liquid rock. The magic of the Zemach priests was countered each time by the concerted magic of the knights of the church. For 3 days, the armies were locked in battle before the Zemachs were pushed back. Their retreat became more rapid, eventually turning into a rout. Otha's horde finally broke and ran toward the safety of the border.
Terrific! Talon exclaimed excitedly. And then did our army invade Zemach?
They were too exhausted, Barrett told him. They had won the battle, but not without great cost. Fully half of the church knights lay slain upon the battlefield, and the armies of the Aline kings numbered their dead by the scores of thousands.
They could have done something, couldn't they?
Barrett nodded sadly. They cared for their wounded and buried their dead. Then they all went home.
That's all?
Talon asked incredulously.
This isn't much of a story if that's all they did, Barrett.
They had no choice. They'd stripped the Western kingdoms of every able-bodied man to fight the war and had left the crops untended. Winter was coming, and there was no food. They managed to eke their way through that winter, but so many men had been killed or maimed in the battle that when spring came, there weren't enough people, in the West or in Zemach, to plant new crops. The result was famine. For a century, the only concern in all of Eosia was food. The swords and lances were put aside, and the war horses were hitched to plows.
They never talk about that sort of thing in other stories I've heard, Talon sniffed.
That's because those are only stories, Barrett told him. This really happened. Anyway, he went on. The war and the famine which followed caused great changes. The militant orders were forced to labor in the field beside the common people, and they gradually began to distance themselves from the church. Pardon me, Your Grace, he said to Dolmont, but at that time the aristocracy was too far removed from the concerns of the commons fully to understand their suffering.
There's no need to apologize, Barrett, Dolmont replied sadly. The church has freely admitted her blunders during that era.
Barrett nodded. The church knights became increasingly secularized. The original intent of the aristocracy had been that the knights should be armed monks who would live in their chapter houses when they weren't fighting. That concept began to fade. The dreadful casualties in their ranks made it necessary for them to seek a source for new recruits. The preceptors of the orders journeyed to Krellos and laid the problem before the aristocracy in the strongest of terms. The main stumbling block to the recruitment had always been the vow of celibacy. At the insistence of the preceptors, the aristocracy relaxed that rule, and church knights were permitted to take wives and father children.
Are you married, Sparhawk?
Talon suddenly asked.
No, the knight replied.
Why not?
He hasn't found any woman silly enough to have him, Calton laughed. He's not very pretty to begin with, and he's got a foul temper.
Talon looked at Barrett.
That's the end of the story, then? He asked critically. A good story needs to end, you know. Something like, and they all lived happily ever after. Yours just sort of dribbles off without going any place.
History just keeps going, Talon. There aren't any ends. The militant orders are now as much involved in political affairs as they are in the affairs of the church, and no one can say what lies in store for them in the future.
Dolmont sighed. All too true, he agreed. I wish it might have been otherwise, but perhaps God has his reasons for ordaining things this way.
Well, wait a minute, Talon objected. This all started when you were going to tell me about Otha and Zemach. He sort of fell out of the story a way back. Why are we so worried about him now?
Otha is mobilizing his armies again, Sparhawk told him.
Are we doing anything about it?
We're watching him. If he comes again, we'll meet him the same way we did the last time. Sparhawk looked around at the yellow grass gleaming in the bright morning sunlight. If we want to get to Krellos before the month's out, we're going to have to move a little faster, he said, touching his spurs to Farron's flanks. They rode east for 3 days, stopping each night in wayside inns. Sparhawk concealed a certain tolerant amusement as Talon, inspired by Barrett's recounting of the age-old story, fiercely beheaded thistles with a stick as they rode along. It was mid-afternoon of the third day when they crested a long hill to look down upon the vast sprawl of Krellos, the seat of the Aline Church. The city lay within no specific kingdom, but sat instead at the place where Alenia, Arcium, Camoria, Lamrican, and Pelosia touched. It was by far the largest city in all of Eosia. Since it was a church city, it was dotted with spires and domes. At certain times of the day, the air above it shimmered with the sound of bells, calling the faithful to prayer. No city so large, however, could be given over entirely to churches. Commerce, almost as much as religion, dominated the society of the holy city, and the palaces of wealthy merchants vied with those of the patriarchs of the church for splendor and opulence. The center and focus of the city, however, was the Basilica of Krellos, a vast, domed cathedral of gleaming marble erected to the glory of God. The power emanating from the basilica was enormous, and it touched the lives of all Elenes, from the snowy wastes of northern Talicia to the deserts of Rendor. Talon, who until now had never been out of Samira, gaped in astonishment at the enormous city spread before them, gleaming in the winter sunlight.
Good God! He breathed, almost reverently.
Yes, Dolmont agreed. He is good, and this is one of his most splendid works.
Flute, however, seemed unimpressed. She drew out her pipes and played a mocking little melody on them as if to dismiss all the splendors of Krellos as unimportant.
Will you go directly to the Basilica, Your Grace? Sparhawk asked.
No, Dolmont replied. It's been a tiring journey, and I'll need my wits about me when I present this matter to the aerocracy. Annius has many friends in the highest councils of the church, and they won't like what I'm going to say to them.
They can't possibly doubt your words, Your Grace.
Perhaps not, but they can try to twist them around.
Dolmont tugged thoughtfully at one earlobe.
I think my report might have more impact if I have cooperation. Are you any good at public appearances?
Only if he can use his sword, Calton said.
Dolmont smiled faintly.
Come to my house tomorrow, Sparhawk. We'll go over your testimony together.
Is that altogether legal, Your Grace? Sparhawk asked.
I won't ask you to lie under oath, Sparhawk. All I want to do is suggest to you how you should phrase your answers to certain questions.
He smiled again.
I don't want you to surprise me when we're before the aerocracy. I hate surprises.
All right then, Your Grace, Sparhawk agreed. They rode on down the hill to the great bronze gates of the holy city. The guards there saluted Dolmont and let them all pass without question. Beyond the gate lay a broad street that could only be called a boulevard. Huge houses stood on either side, seeming almost to shoulder at each other in their eagerness to command the undivided attention of passers-by. The street teemed with people. Although many of them wore the drab smocks of workmen, the vast majority were garbed in somber, ecclesiastical black.
"Is everybody here a churchman?" Talon asked.
The boy's eyes were wide as the sights of Krellos overwhelmed him. The cynical young thief from the back alleys of Samira had finally seen something that he could not shrug off.
"Hardly," Calton replied,
But in Krellos, one commands a bit more respect if he's thought to be affiliated with the church, so everybody wears black.
Frankly, I wouldn't mind seeing a bit more color in the streets of Krellos, Dolmont said. All this unrelieved black depresses me.
Why not start a new trend then, Your Grace? Calton suggested. The next time you present yourself at the Basilica, wear a pink cassock, or maybe emerald green. You'd look very nice in green.
The dome would collapse if I did, Dolmont said wryly.
The Patriarch's house, unlike the palaces of most other high churchmen, was simple and unadorned. It was set slightly back from the street and was surrounded by well-trimmed shrubs and an iron fence. We'll go on to the chapter house then, Your Grace, Sparhawk said as they stopped at Dolmont's gate. The Patriarch nodded.
And I'll see you tomorrow.
Sparhawk saluted and then led the others on down the street. He's a good man, isn't he? Calton said. One of the best, Sparhawk replied. The church is lucky to have him. The chapter house of the Pandian Knights in Krellos was a bleak-looking stone building on a little-traveled side street. Although it was not moated, as was the one in Samira, it was nonetheless surrounded by a high wall and blocked off from the street by a formidable gate. Sparhawk went through the ritual which gained them entry, and they dismounted in the courtyard. The governor of the chapter house, a stout man named Nashen, came bustling down the stairs to greet them.
Our house is honored, Sir Sparhawk, he said, clasping the big knight's hand. How did things turn out in Samira?
We managed to pull Annius's teeth, Sparhawk replied.
And how did he take it?
He looked a little sick.
Good.
Nashen turned to Sophronia.
Oh, welcome, little mother,
he greeted her, kissing both her palms.
Nashen, she replied gravely, I see that you're not missing too many meals.
He laughed and slapped at his paunch.
Every man needs a vice or two, he said. Come inside, all of you. I've smuggled a skin of Arcian Red into the house, for my stomach's sake, of course, and we can all have a goblet or two.
You see how it works, Sparhawk? Calton said. Rules can be bent if you know the right people. Nashen's study was draped and carpeted in red, and the ornate table which served as his desk was inlaid with gold and mother-of-pearl.
A gesture, he said apologetically as he led them into the room and looked about. In Krellos we must make these little genuflections in the direction of opulence if we are to be taken seriously.
It's all right, Nashen, Sophronia told him. You weren't selected as governor of this chapter house because of your humility.
One must keep up appearances, Sophronia, he said.
He sighed.
I was never that good a knight, he admitted. I'm at best only mediocre with the lance, and most of my spells tend to crumble on me about halfway through.
He drew in a deep breath and looked around.
I'm a good administrator, though. I know the church and her politics, and I can serve the Order and Lord Vanyan in that arena probably far better than I could on the field.
We all do what we can, Sparhawk told him. I'm told that God appreciates our best efforts.
Sometimes I feel that I've disappointed him, Nashen said. Somewhere deep inside me, I think I might have done better.
Don't flagellate yourself, Nashen, Sophronia advised. The Aline God is reputed to be most forgiving. You've done what you could.
They took seats around Nashen's ornate table, and the governor summoned an acolyte who brought goblets and the skin of the deep Arcian wine. At Sophronia's request, he also sent for tea for her and milk for Flute and Talon.
We don't necessarily need to mention this to Lord Vanyan, do we?
Nashen said to Sparhawk as he lifted the wineskin. Wild horses couldn't drag it out of me, my lord, Sparhawk told him, holding out his goblet. So, Calton said, what's happening here in Krellos?
Troubled times, Calton, Nashen replied. Troubled times. The archprelate ages, and the entire city is holding its breath in anticipation of his death.
Who will be the new archprelate? Sparhawk asked.
Oh, at the moment there's no way to know. Clavonius is in no condition to name a successor, and Annius of Samira is spending money like water to gain the throne.
What about Dolmont? Calton asked.
He's too self-effacing, I'm afraid, Nashin replied. He's so dedicated to the church that he doesn't have the sense of self that one needs to have to aspire to the golden throne in the basilica. Not only that, he's made enemies.
I like enemies, Calton grinned. They give you a reason to keep your sword sharp.
Nashin looked at Sophronia. Is there something afoot in Styricum? He asked her.
What exactly do you mean?
The city is suddenly awash with Styrix, he replied. They say that they're here to seek instruction in the Aline faith.
That's absurd.
I thought so myself. The church has been trying to convert the Styrix for 3,000 years without much success, and now they come flocking to Krellos of their own accord, begging to be converted.
No sane Styrix would do that, she insisted. Our gods are jealous, and they punish apostasy severely. Her eyes narrowed. Have any of these pilgrims identified their place of origin? She asked.
Not that I've heard. They all look like common rural Styrix.
Perhaps they've made a longer journey than they're willing to reveal.
You think they might be Zemox? Sparhawk asked her.
Otha's already infested Eastern Lamerkin with his agents, she replied. Krellos is the center of the Aline world. It's a logical place for espionage and disruption. She considered it. We're likely to be here for a while, she observed. We have to wait for the arrival of the knights from the other orders. I think perhaps we might spend the time investigating these unusual postulants.
I can't really get too much involved in that, Sparhawk disagreed. I have things far more important on my mind just now. We'll deal with Otha and his Zemox when the time comes. Right now, I have to concentrate on restoring Alana to her throne, and preventing the deaths of certain friends. He spoke obliquely, since he had kept to himself the details of what she had told him had taken place in the throne room in Samira.
It's all right, Sparhawk, she assured him. I understand your concern. I'll take Calton with me and we'll see what we can turn up.
They spent the remainder of the day in quiet conversation in Nashin's ornate study, and the following morning, Sparhawk dressed in a mail coat and a simple hooded robe and rode across town to Dolmont's house, where the two of them carefully went over what had happened in Samira and Arcium.
It would be futile to level any direct charges at Anius, Dolmont said. So it's probably best to admit any references to him, or to Hopperin. Let's just present the affair as a plot to discredit the Pandian Order, and leave it at that. The aristocracy will draw its own conclusions, he smiled faintly. The least damaging of those conclusions will be that Anius made a fool of himself in public. If nothing else, that might help to stiffen the resolve of the neutral patriarchs when the time comes to select a new archprelate.
That's something anyway, Sparhawk said. Are we going to present the matter of Arissa's so-called marriage at the same time?
I don't think so, Dolmont replied. It's really not a significant enough thing to require the consideration of the entire aristocracy. The declarations of Arissa's spinsterhood can come from the Patriarch of Vardenice. The alleged wedding took place in his district, and he would be the logical one to draw up the denial that it took place.
A smile touched his ascetic face.
Besides, he added, he's a friend of mine.
Clever, Sparhawk said, admiringly.
I rather liked it, Dolmont said modestly.
When are we going before the aristocracy?
Tomorrow morning. There's no point in waiting. All that would do is give Anius time to alert his friends in the Basilica.
Do you want me to come by here and ride to the Basilica with you?
No. Let's go in separately. Let's not give them the slightest hint of what we're up to.
You're very good at political chicanery, Your Grace, Sparhawk grinned.
Of course I am. How do you think I got to be a patriarch? Come to the Basilica during the third hour after sunrise. That should give me time to present my report first, and to answer all the questions and objections that Anius supporters are likely to raise.
Very well, Your Grace, Sparhawk said, rising to his feet.
Be careful tomorrow, Sparhawk. They'll try to trip you up, and for God's sake, don't lose your temper.
I'll try to remember that. The following morning, Sparhawk dressed carefully. His black armor gleamed, and his cape and silver surcoat had been freshly pressed. Farron had been groomed until his roan coat shone, and his hooves had been oiled to make them glossy. "Don't let them back you into a corner, Sparhawk," Calton warned, as he and Curic boosted the big man into his saddle. "Churchmen can be very devious." "I'll watch myself." Sparhawk gathered his reins and nudged Farron with his heels. The big roan pranced out through the chapter house gate and into the teeming streets of the holy city. The domed basilica of Krellos dominated the entire city. It was built on a low hill, and it soared toward heaven, gleaming in the wintry sun. The guards at the bronze portal admitted Sparhawk respectfully, and he dismounted before the marble stairs that led up to the great doors. He handed Farron's reins to a monk, adjusted the strap on his shield, and then mounted the steps, his spurs ringing on the marble. At the top of the stairs, an officious young churchman in a black cassock blocked his path.
"Sir Knight," the young man protested, "you may not enter while under arms."
"You're wrong, Your Reverence," Sparhawk told him. "Those rules don't apply to the militant orders."
"I've never heard of any such exception."
"You have now. I don't want any trouble with you, friend, but I've been summoned by the Patriarch Domont, and I'm going inside."
"But..."
"There's an extensive library here, neighbor. Why don't you go look up the rules again? I'm sure you'll find that you've missed a few. Now stand aside." He brushed past the man in the black cassock and went on into the cool, incense-smelling cathedral. He made the customary bow toward the jewel-encrusted altar and moved on down the broad central aisle and the multicolored lights streaming through tall, stained-glass windows. A sacristan stood by the altar, vigorously polishing a silver chalice. "Good morning, friend," Sparhawk said to him in his quiet voice. The sacristan almost dropped the chalice.
"You startled me, Sir Knight," he said, laughing nervously. "I didn't hear you come up behind me."
"It's the carpeting," Sparhawk said. "It muffles the sound of footsteps. I understand that the members of the aristocracy are in session." The sacristan nodded. "Patriarch Domont summoned me to testify in a matter he's presenting this morning. Could you tell me where they're meeting?"
"In the Archprelate's audience chamber, I believe. Do you want me to show you the way, Sir Knight?"
"I know where it is. Thanks, neighbor." Sparhawk went across the front of the nave and out through a side door into an echoing marble corridor. He removed his helm and tucked it under his arm and proceeded on along the corridor until he reached a large room where a dozen churchmen sat at tables sorting through stacks of documents. One of the black-robed men looked up, saw Sparhawk in the doorway, and rose.
"May I help you, Sir Knight?" he asked.
The top of his head was bald, and wispy tufts of gray hair stuck out over his ears like wings. "The name is Sparhawk, Your Reverence. The Patriarch Domont summoned me here."
"Ah, yes," the bald churchman said. "The Patriarch advised me that he was expecting you. I'll go and tell him that you've arrived. Would you care to sit down while you're waiting?"
"No thanks, Your Reverence. I'll stand. It's a little awkward to sit down when you're wearing a sword." The churchman smiled a bit wistfully.
"I wouldn't know about that," he said. "What's it like?"
"It's overrated," Sparhawk told him. "Would you tell the Patriarch that I'm here?"
"At once, Sir Sparhawk."
The churchman turned and crossed the room to the far door, with his sandals slapping on the marble floor. After a few moments, he came back.
"The Patriarch says that you're to go right on in, the Archprelate's with them."
"That's a surprise. I've heard that he's been ill."
"This is one of his better days, I think."
The churchman led the way across the room and opened the door for Sparhawk. The audience chamber was flanked on either side by tier upon tier of high-backed benches. The benches were filled with elderly churchmen in sober black, the aristocracy of the Aline Church. At the front of the room, on a raised dais, sat a large golden throne, and seated upon that throne, in a white satin robe and golden mitre, was the archprelate, Clavonus. The old man was dozing.
In the center of the room stood an ornate lectern. Dolmont was there, with a sheaf of parchment on the slanted shelf before him.
"Ah," he said, "Sir Sparhawk, so good of you to come."
"My pleasure, Your Grace," Sparhawk replied.
"Brothers,"
Dolmont said to the other members of the aristocracy,
"I have the honor to present the Pandian knight, Sir Sparhawk."
"We have heard of Sir Sparhawk," a lean-faced patriarch seated in the frontier on the left said coldly. "Why is he here, Dolmont?"
"To present evidence in the matter we were just discussing, Makova,"
Dolmont replied distantly. "I have heard quite enough already."
"Speak for yourself, Makova,"
a jovial-looking fat man said from the right tier.
"The militant hoarders are the arm of the church, and their members are always welcome at our deliberations."
The two men glared at each other.
"Since Sir Sparhawk was instrumental in uncovering and thwarting this plot,"
Dolmont said smoothly,
"I thought that his testimony might prove enlightening."
"Oh, get on with it, Dolmont,"
the lean-faced patriarch on the left said irritably. "We have matters of much greater importance to take up this morning."
"It shall be as the esteemed patriarch of Combe wishes,"
Dolmont bowed.
"Sir Sparhawk," he said then, "do you give your oath as a knight of the church that your testimony shall be the truth?"
"I do, Your Grace," Sparhawk affirmed.
"Please tell the assembly how you uncovered this plot."
"Of course, Your Grace." Sparhawk then recounted most of the conversation between Harperin and Krager, omitting their names, the name of the primate Annius, and all references to Ilana.
"Is it your custom to eavesdrop on private conversation, Sir Sparhawk?" Makova asked a bit spitefully.
"When it involves the security of the church or the state, yes, Your Grace. I'm sworn to defend both."
"Ah, yes. I'd forgotten that you are also the champion of the Queen of Alenia. Does that sometimes not divide your loyalties, Sir Sparhawk?"
"It hasn't so far, Your Grace. The interests of the church and the state are seldom in conflict with each other in Alenia."
"Well said, Sir Sparhawk,"
the fat churchman on the right approved. The Patriarch of Combe leaned over and whispered something to the sallow man sitting beside him.
"What did you do after you learned of this conspiracy, Sir Sparhawk?"
Dolmont asked then. "We gathered our forces and rode down into Arcium to intercept the men who were to carry out the attack."
"And why did you not advise the primate of Samira of this so-called conspiracy?" Makova asked.
"The scheme involved an attack on a house in Arcium, Your Grace," Sparhawk replied. "The primate of Samira has no authority there, so the matter didn't concern him."
"Nor the Pandians either, I should say. Why did you not just alert the Cyrenic knights and let them deal with things?"
Makova looked around smugly at those seated near him, as if he had just made a killing point. "The plot was designed to discredit our order, Your Grace. We felt that gave us sufficient reason to attend to the matter ourselves. Besides, the Cyrenics have their own concerns, and we didn't want to trouble them with so minor an affair." Makova grunted sourly.
"What happened then, Sir Sparhawk?" Dolmont asked.
"Things went more or less as expected, Your Grace. We alerted Count Radun, then, when the mercenaries arrived, we fell on them from behind. Not very many of them escaped."
"You attacked them from behind without warning?" Patriarch Makova looked outraged. "Is this the vaunted heroism of the Pandian knights?"
"You're nitpicking, Makova,"
the jovial-looking man on the other side of the aisle snorted.
"Your precious primate Annius made a fool of himself. Quit trying to smooth it over by attacking this knight and trying to impugn his testimony."
He looked shrewdly at Sparhawk.
"Would you care to hazard a guess as to the source of this conspiracy, Sir Sparhawk?" he asked.
"We are not here to listen to speculation, Emben,"
Makova snapped quickly.
"The witness can testify only to what he knows, not what he guesses."
"The Patriarch of Combe is right, Your Grace," Sparhawk said to Patriarch Emben. "I swore to speak only the truth, and guesses usually fly wide of that mark.
The Pandian Order has offended many people in the past century or so. We are sometimes an acerbic group of men, stiff-necked and unforgiving. Many find that quality in us unpleasant, and old hatreds die hard.
True, Emblin conceded. If it came to the defense of the faith, however, I would prefer to place my trust in you stiff-necked and unforgiving Pandians rather than some others I could name. Old hatreds, as you say, die hard, but so do new ones. I've heard about what's going on in Delenia, and it's not too hard to pick out somebody who might profit from the Pandian's disgrace.
Do you dare to accuse the primate Anius? Makova cried, jumping to his feet with his eyes bulging.
Oh, sit down, Makova, Emben said in disgust. You contaminate us by your very presence. Everybody in this chamber knows who owns you.
You accuse me?
Who paid for that new palace of yours, Makova? 6 months ago you tried to borrow money from me, and now you seem to have all you need. Isn't that curious? Who's subsidizing you, Makova?
What's all this shouting about?
A feeble voice asked. Sparhawk looked sharply at the golden throne at the front of the chamber. The arch-prelate Clavonus had come awake and was blinking in confusion as he looked around. The old man's head was wobbling on his stringy neck, and his eyes were bleary.
A spirited discussion, most holy,
Dolmont said mildly.
Now you've gone and woken me up,
the arch-prelate said petulantly.
And I was having such a nice dream.
He reached up, pulled off his mitre, and threw it on the floor. Then he sank back on his throne, pouting.
Would the arch-prelate care to hear of the matter under discussion? Dolmont asked.
No, I wouldn't,
Clavonus snapped.
So there.
Then he cackled, as if his infantile outburst had been some enormous joke. The laughter trailed off, and he scowled at them.
I want to go back to my room, he declared. Get out of here, all of you.
The aristocracy rose to its feet and began to file out.
You too, Dolmont,
the arch-prelate insisted in a shrill voice.
And send Sister Clentis to me. She's the only one who really cares about me. As you wish, most holy,
Dolmont said, bowing. When they were outside, Sparhawk walked beside the Patriarch of Deimos. How long has he been like this? He asked. Dolmont sighed.
For a year now, at least, he replied. His mind has been failing for quite some time, but it's only in the past year that his senility has reached this level. Who is Sister Clentis? His keeper, his nursemaid, actually.
Is his condition widely known?
There are rumors, of course, but we've managed to keep his true state a secret.
Dolmont sighed again.
Don't judge him by the way he is now, Sparhawk. When he was younger, he honored the throne of the Archprelacy.
Sparhawk nodded. I know, he agreed. How is his health otherwise?
Not good. He's very frail. It cannot be much longer.
Perhaps that's why Anius is beginning to move so quickly. Sparhawk shifted his silver embossed shield. Time's on his side, you know. Dolmont made a sour face.
Yes, he agreed. That's what makes your mission so vital.
Another churchman came up to join them.
Well, Dolmont, he said. A very interesting morning. Just how deeply was Anius involved in the scheme?
I didn't say anything about the primate of Samira, Yaris.
Dolmont protested with mock innocence.
You didn't have to. It all fits together a bit too neatly. I don't think anybody on the council missed your point.
Do you know the Patriarch of Vardenai, Sparhawk?
Dolmont asked. We've met a few times. Sparhawk bowed slightly to the other churchman, his armor creaking. Your Grace, he said.
It's good to see you again, Sir Sparhawk, Yaris replied. How are things in Samira?
Tense, Sparhawk said. Patriarch Yaris looked at Dolmont.
You know that Makova's going to report everything that happened this morning to Anius, don't you?
I wasn't trying to keep it a secret. Anius made an ass of himself, Considering his aspirations, that element of his personality is highly relevant.
It is indeed, Dolmont. You've made another enemy this morning.
Makova's never been that fond of me anyway. Incidentally, Yaris, Sparhawk and I would like to present a certain matter to you for your consideration.
Oh?
It involves another ploy by the primate of Samura.
Then let's thwart him by all means.
I was hoping you might feel that way about it.
What's he up to this time?
He presented a spurious marriage certificate to the royal council in Samura.
Who got married?
Princess Arissa and Duke Austin.
That's ridiculous.
Princess Arissa said almost the same thing.
You'll swear to that.
Dolmont nodded.
So will Sparhawk, he added.
I assume that the point of the whole thing was to legitimize Lycius.
Dolmont nodded again.
Well then, why don't we see if we can disrupt that? Let's go speak with my secretary. He can draw up the necessary document.
The Patriarch of Vardanice chuckled. Annius is having a bad month, I'd say.
This will make two plots in a row that have failed, and Sparhawk's been involved both times.
He looked at the big Pandian.
Keep your armor on, my boy, he suggested. Annius might decide to have the area between your shoulder blades decorated with a dagger hilt.
After Dolmont and Sparhawk had given their depositions concerning the statements of Princess Arissa, they left the Patriarch of Vardanice and continued along the corridor to the nave of the Basilica.
Dolmont, Sparhawk said, do you have any idea about why so many Styrix are here in Krellos?
I've heard about it. The story is that they're seeking instruction in our faith.
Sophronia says that's an absurdity.
Dolmont made a wry face.
She's probably right. I've labored for a lifetime, and I haven't as yet managed to convert a single Styrix.
They're very attached to their gods, Sparhawk said. I'm not trying to be offensive, Dolmont, but there seems to be a very close personal relationship between the Styrix and their gods. Our god is perhaps a bit remote.
I'll mention that the next time I talk to him.
Dolmont smiled.
I'm sure he values your opinion.
Sparhawk laughed.
It was a bit presumptuous, wasn't it?
Yes, as a matter of fact it was. How long do you think it's going to be until you can leave for Barata?
Several days, anyway. I hate to lose the time, but the knights from the other orders have long journeys to make to reach Krellos, and I'm more or less obliged to wait for them. All this waiting is making me very impatient, but there's no help for it, I'm afraid.
He pursed his lips.
I think I'll spend the time nosing around a bit. It'll give me something to do, and all these Styrix are making me curious.
Be careful in the streets of Krellos, Sparhawk.
Dolmont advised seriously.
They can be very dangerous.
The whole world is dangerous lately, Dolmont. I'll keep you posted on what I find out.
Then Sparhawk turned and went down the corridor with his spurs clinking on the marble floor.
Chapter 13. It was nearly noon when Sparhawk returned to the chapter house. He had ridden slowly through the busy streets of the holy city, paying scant attention to the crowds around him. The deterioration of the arch-prelate Clavonus had saddened him. Despite the rumors that had been circulating of late, actually to see the revered old man's condition had come as a profound personal shock. He stopped at the heavy gate and perfunctorily went through the ritual that admitted him. Calton was waiting in the courtyard.
Well? The blonde man asked. How did it go?
Sparhawk dismounted heavily and pulled off his helmet.
I don't know if we changed any minds, he replied.
The patriarchs who support Annius still support him. The ones who oppose him are still on our side, and those who are neutral are still on the fence.
It was a waste of time, then.
Not entirely, I guess. After this, it might be a little harder for Annius to win over any more uncommitted votes.
I wish you'd make up your mind, Sparhawk.
Calton looked closely at his friend.
You're in a sour mood.
What really happened? Clavonis was there. That's a surprise. How did he look? Awful. He is 85, Sparhawk. You couldn't expect him to look very impressive. People wear out, you know.
His mind has gone, Calton, Sparhawk said sadly. He's childish now. Dolmont doesn't think he's going to last much longer.
That's bad?
Sparhawk nodded.
That makes it fairly important for us to get to Barat and back in a hurry then, doesn't it?
Urgent, Sparhawk agreed.
Do you think we should ride on ahead and let the knights from the other orders catch up with us later?
I wish we could. I hate the idea of Alana sitting alone in that throne room, but I don't think we dare.
Comier was right about a show of unity, and the other orders are sometimes a little touchy. Let's not start off by offending them.
Did you and Dolmont talk to somebody about Orisa?
Sparhawk nodded. The Patriarch of Vardanice is handling it.
The day wasn't an absolute waste, then.
Sparhawk grunted. I want to change out of this. He rapped on the breastplate of his armor with his knuckles. You want me to unsaddle Farron for you?
No, I'll be going back out.
Where's Sophronia?
In her room, I think. Have somebody saddle her horse.
Is she going somewhere?
Probably.
Sparhawk went on up the stairs and entered the chapter house. It was about a quarter of an hour later when he tapped on Sophronia's door. He had removed his armor and now wore a mail coat beneath a nondescript gray cloak that bore no insignia of his rank or his order.
It's me, Sophronia, he said through the panels of the door.
Come in, Sparhawk, she said.
He opened the door and stepped in quietly. She was sitting in a large chair with flute in her lap. The child was sleeping with a contented little smile on her face.
Did things go well at the Basilica? Sophronia asked.
It's a little hard to say, he replied. Churchmen are very good at hiding their emotions. Did you and Calton find out anything about all the Styrics here in Krellos yesterday? She nodded.
They're concentrated in the quarter near the East Gate. They have a house there somewhere that seems to be a headquarters of some sort. We weren't able to locate it exactly, though.
Why don't we go see if we can find it? He suggested. I need something to do. I'm feeling a bit restless.
Restless? You, Sparhawk, the man of stone?
Impatience, I suppose. I want to get started for Barada.
She nodded. Then she rose, lifting flute easily, and laid the child on the bed. Gently, she covered the little girl with a gray woolen blanket. Flute briefly opened her dark eyes, then smiled and went back to sleep. Sophronia kissed the small face, then turned to Sparhawk.
Shall we go, then? She said.
You're very fond of her, aren't you? Sparhawk asked as the two of them walked along the corridor leading towards the courtyard.
It goes a bit deeper than that. Someday, perhaps, you'll understand.
Have you any idea where this Styric house might be?
There's a shopkeeper in the market near the East Gate. He sold some Styrics a number of sides of meat. The porter who delivered them knows where the house is.
Why didn't you question the porter?
He wasn't there yesterday.
Maybe he'll make it to work today.
It's worth a try.
He stopped and gave her a direct look. I'm not trying to pry into the secrets you've chosen not to reveal, Sophronia. But could you distinguish between ordinary, rural Styrics and Zemoks?
It's possible, she admitted, unless they're taking steps to conceal their true identity.
They went on down into the courtyard where Calton waited with Farron and Sophronia's white palfrey. The blonde knight had an angry expression on his face.
Your horse bit me, Sparhawk, he said accusingly.
You know him well enough not to turn your back on him. Did he draw blood?
No, Calton admitted.
Then he was only being playful. It shows that he likes you.
Thanks, Calton said flatly. Do you want me to come along?
No. I think we want to be more or less inconspicuous, and on occasion, you have trouble managing that.
Sometimes your charm overwhelms me, Sparhawk. We're sworn to speak the truth.
Sparhawk helped Sophronia into her saddle, then mounted Farron. We should be back before dark, he told his friend.
Don't hurry on my account.
Sparhawk led the small, steric woman out through the gate and into the side street beyond.
"He turns everything into a joke, doesn't he?" Sophronia observed.
"Most things, yes. He's been laughing at the world since he was a boy. I think that's why I like him so much. My view of things tends to be a little more bleak, and he helps me keep my perspective."
They rode on through the now teeming streets of Krellos. Although many local merchants affected the somber black of churchmen, visitors usually did not, and their bright clothing stood out by contrast. Travelers from Camoria in particular were highly colorful, since their customary silk garments did not fade with the passage of time and remained brightly red or green or blue. The marketplace to which Sophronia led him was some distance from the chapter house, and it was perhaps 3/4 of an hour before they reached it.
"How did you find this shopkeeper?" Sparhawk asked.
"There are certain staples in the steric diet," she replied. "Elenes don't eat those things very often."
"I thought you said that this porter delivered some sides of meat."
"Goat, Sparhawk. Elenes don't care much for goat." He shuddered. "How provincial you are," she said lightly. "If it doesn't come from a cow, you won't eat it."
"I suppose it's what you're used to."
"I'd better go to the shop alone," she said. "Sometimes you're a bit intimidating, dear one. We want answers from the porter, and we might not get them if you frighten him. Watch my horse."
She handed him her reins and then moved off through the market. Sparhawk watched as she went across the bustling square to speak with a shabby-looking fellow in a blood-smeared canvas smock. After a short time, she returned. He got down and helped her back onto her horse.
"Did he tell you where the house is?" he asked.
She nodded.
"It's not far, near the east gate.
Let's go have a look."
As they started out, Sparhawk did something uncharacteristically impulsive. He reached out and took the small woman's hand.
"I love you, little mother," he told her. "Yes," she said calmly, "I know. It's nice of you to say it, though."
Then she smiled. It was an impish little smile that somehow reminded him of Flute.
"Another lesson for you, Sparhawk," she said. "When you're having dealings with a woman, you cannot say, 'I love you,' too often."
"I'll remember that. Does the same thing apply to Aleen women?"
"It applies to all women, Sparhawk. Gender is a far more important distinction than race."
"I shall be guided by you, Sophronia."
"Have you been reading medieval poetry again?"
"Me?"
They rode through the marketplace and on into the run-down quarter near the east gate of Krellos. While not perhaps the same as the slums of Samura, this part of the holy city was far less opulent than the area around the basilica. There was less color here, for one thing. The tunics of the men in the street were uniformly drab, and the few merchants that were in the crowd wore garments which were faded and threadbare. They did, however, have the self-important expressions which all merchants, successful or not, automatically assume. Then, at the far end of the street, Sparhawk saw a short man in a lumpy, unbleached smock of homespun wool.
"Steric," he said shortly.
Sophronia nodded and drew up the hood of her white robe so that it covered her face. Sparhawk straightened in his saddle and carefully assumed an arrogant, condescending expression such as the servant of some important personage might wear. They passed the steric, who stepped cautiously aside without paying them any particular heed. Like all members of his race, the steric had dark, almost black hair and a pale skin. He was shorter than the Alenes who passed him in this narrow street, and the bones in his face were prominent, as if he had somehow not quite been completed.
"Zemok?" Sparhawk asked, after they had passed the man.
"It's impossible to say," Sophronia replied.
"Is he concealing his identity with the spell?"
She spread her hands helplessly.
"There's no way to tell, Sparhawk. Either he's just an ordinary backwoods steric, with nothing on his mind but his next meal, or he's a very subtle magician who's playing the bumpkin to block out attempts to probe him."
Sparhawk swore under his breath. "This might not be as easy as I thought," he said.
Let's go on, then, and see what we can find out. The house to which Zephrenia had been directed sat at the end of a cul-de-sac, a short street that went nowhere.
That's going to be difficult to watch without being obvious, Sparhawk said, as they rode slowly past the mouth of the narrow street.
Not really, Zephrenia disagreed. She reined in her palfrey. We need to talk with the shopkeeper there on the corner.
Did you want to buy something?
Not exactly buy, Sparhawk. Come along, you'll see.
She slid down out of her saddle and tied the reins of her delicate white horse to a post outside the shop she had indicated. She looked around briefly.
Will your great war horse discourage anyone who might want to steal my gentle little Chell? She asked. She laid her hand affectionately on the white horse's neck.
I'll talk to him about it.
Would you?
Farron, Sparhawk said to the ugly roan, stay here and protect Sophrenia's mare. Farron nickered, his ears pricked eagerly forward. You big old fool, Sparhawk laughed. Farron snapped at him, his teeth clacking together at the empty air inches from Sparhawk's ear. Be nice, Sparhawk murmured.
Inside the shop, a room devoted to the display of cheap furniture, Sophrenia's attitude became ingratiating, even oddly submissive.
Good Master Merchant, she said, with an uncharacteristic tone in her voice, we serve a great Pelosian noble who has come to Krellos to seek solace for his soul in the holy city.
I don't deal with Styrix, the merchant said rudely, glowering at Sophrenia. There are too many of you filthy heathens in Krellos already.
He assumed an expression of extreme distaste, all the while making what Sparhawk knew to be totally ineffective gestures to ward off magic.
Look, huckster, the big knight said, affecting an insulting Pelosian-accented manner. Do not rise above yourself. My master Chatelaine and I will be treated with respect, regardless of your feeble-minded bigotry. The shopkeeper bristled at that. Why? He began to bluster.
Sparhawk smashed the top of a cheap table into splinters with a single blow of his fist. Then he seized the shopman's collar and pulled him forward so that they were eye to eye.
Do we understand each other? He said in a dreadful voice that hovered just this side of a whisper.
What we require, good Master Merchant, Sophrenia said smoothly, is a goodly set of chambers facing the street. Our master has been ever fond of watching the ebb and flow of humanity.
She lowered her eyelashes modestly.
Have you such a place above stairs?
The shopkeeper's face was a study in conflicting emotions as he turned to mount the stairs towards the upper floor. The chambers above were shabby. One might even go so far as to say ratty. They had at some time in the past been painted, but the pea-soup green paint had peeled and now hung in long strips from the walls. Sparhawk and Sophrenia were not interested in paint, however. It was to the dirty window at the front of the main chamber that their eyes went.
There's more, little lady, the shopkeeper said more respectfully now.
We can conduct our own inspection, good Master Merchant.
She cocked her head slightly.
Was that the step of a customer I heard from below?
The shopkeeper blinked, and then he bolted downstairs.
Can you see the house up the street from the window? Sophrenia asked.
The panes are dirty. Sparhawk lifted the hem of his gray cloak to wipe away the dust and grime.
Don't, she said sharply. Styric eyes are very sharp.
All right, he said. I'll look through the dust. Aline eyes are just as sharp. He looked at her. Does that happen every time you go out? He asked.
Yes. Common Alines are not much smarter than common Styrix. Frankly, I'd rather have a conversation with a toad than with either breed.
Toads can talk? He was a little surprised at that.
If you know what you're listening for, yes. They're not very stimulating conversationalists, though.
The house at the end of the street was not impressive. The lower floor was constructed of fieldstone, crudely mortared together, and the second story was of roughly squared-off timbers.
It seemed somehow set off from the houses around it, as if drawing in a kind of isolated separateness. As they watched, a Styric wearing the poorly woven woolen smock, which was the characteristic garb of his race, moved up the street towards the house. He looked around furtively before he entered.
"Well?" Sparhawk asked. "It's hard to say," Sophronia replied. "It's the same as with that one we saw in the street. He's either simple or very skilled."
"This could take a while."
"Only until dark, if I'm right," she said as she drew a chair up to the window.
In the next several hours, a fair number of Styrics entered the house, and, as the sun sank into a dense, dirty-looking cloud bank on the western horizon, others began to arrive. A Camorrian, in a bright yellow silk robe, went furtively up the cul-de-sac and was immediately admitted. A booted Lamorc, in a polished steel cuirass and accompanied by two crossbow-bearing men-at-arms, marched arrogantly up to the doors of the house and gained entry just as quickly. Then, as the chill winter twilight began to settle over Krellos, a lady in a deep purple robe and attended by a huge manservant in bullhide armor such as that commonly worn by Pelosians, went up the center of the short street, moving with a stiff-legged, abstracted pace. Her eyes seemed vacant and her movements jerky. Her face, however, bore an expression of ineffable ecstasy.
"Strange visitors to a Styric house," Sophronia commented.
Sparhawk nodded and looked around the darkening room. "Do you want some light?" he asked her.
"No, let's not be seen to be here. I'm certain that the street is being watched from the upper floor of the house."
Then she leaned against him, filling his nostrils with the woody fragrance of her hair.
"You can hold my hand, though," she offered. "For some reason, I've always been a little afraid of the dark."
"Of course," he said, taking her small hand in his big one. They sat together for perhaps another quarter of an hour as the street outside grew darker. Suddenly, Sophronia gave an agonized little gasp. "What's the matter?" he asked in alarm. She did not immediately reply, but rose to her feet instead, raising her hands, palm up, above her. A dim figure seemed to stand before her, a figure that was more shadow than substance, and a faint glow seemed to stretch between its widespread, gauntleted hands. Slowly, it held forth that silvery nimbus. The glow grew momentarily brighter, then coalesced into solidity as the shadow before her vanished. She sank back into her chair, holding the long, slender object with a curious kind of sorrowful reverence.
"What was that, Sophronia?" Sparhawk demanded. "Another of the 12 knights has fallen," she said in a voice that was almost a moan. "This is his sword, a part of my burden."
"Vanyan?" he asked, almost choking with a dreadful sense of fear. Her fingers sought the crest of the pommel of the sword she held, feeling the design in the darkness.
"No," she said, "it was Lacus."
Sparhawk felt a wrench of grief. Lacus was an elderly Pandian, a man with snowy hair and a grim visage, whom all the knights of Sparhawk's generation had revered as a teacher and a friend. Sophronia buried her face in Sparhawk's armored shoulder and began to weep.
"I knew him as a boy, Sparhawk," she lamented.
"Let's go back to the chapter house," he suggested gently. "We can do this another day." She lifted her head and wiped her eyes with her hand.
"No, Sparhawk," she said firmly. "Something's happening in that house tonight, something that may not happen again for a while."
He started to say something, but then he felt an oppressive weight that seemed to be located just behind his ears. It was as if someone had just placed the heels of his hands at the back of his skull and pushed inward. Sophronia leaned intently forward.
"Azash!" she hissed.
"What?"
"They're summoning the spirit of Azash,"
she said with a terrible note of urgency in her voice. "That nails it down then, doesn't it?" he said, rising to his feet.
"Sit down, Sparhawk. This isn't played out yet."
"There can't be that many."
And what will you learn if you go up the street and chop the house and everyone in it to pieces? Sit down, watch, and learn.
I'm obliged, Sophronia. It's part of the oath. It has been for 5 centuries.
Bother the oath, she snapped. This is more important.